Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Earlier this month, Admiral Mike Mullen became the first Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman to call for the repeal of the 1993 Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that bans open service by gays in the U.S. military. And once again, the debate is on. The Pentagon has mounted a year-long study, and a new report is out looking at 25 countries around the world, from Canada to Australia to Israel and the U.K., where open gay service is already the norm. This hour, On Point, a global perspective on gay military service and the Don't Ask, Don't Tell debate. You can join the conversation. Does the record in South Africa, Finland, France matter here? And what can we learn from the world on gays and the military? Are you for the change or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lots of testimony again this week from top brass on the subject. Admiral Mike Mullen had been pretty open to it, but yesterday in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee, Chief of Staff, Army Chief of Staff, George Casey, said he has reservations about repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
I do have serious concerns about the impact of the repeal of the law on a force that's fully engaged in two wars and has been at war for 8.5 years. We just don't know the impacts on readiness and military effectiveness.
We just don't know, said the Army leader. And here's Air Force Chief of Staff, General Norman Schwartz.
I have two strong convictions on this. One is that this is not the time to perturb the force that is at the moment stretched by demands in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere without careful deliberation. And two, should the law change, our standards of conduct will continue to apply to all airmen.
More reservations. Earlier in the week, General Raymond Odierno, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, seemed not as concerned.
My opinion is everyone should be allowed to serve as long as we're still able to fight our wars.
And as long as we can fight our wars. And here, the testimony from Admiral Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, earlier this month, saying it's time to change.
It is my personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly would be the right thing to do. No matter how I look at this issue, I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. Joining me now from Washington is Nathaniel Frank, Senior Research Fellow at the Palm Center at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the lead author of a new report out yesterday titled Gays in Foreign Militaries 2010, a Global Primer. Nathaniel Frank, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So how many countries around the world permit the open service by gays?
There are at least 25 countries, and they include all the original NATO countries besides Turkey and the U.S., and they include our staunchest allies in the wars on terror, Britain, Canada, Australia, Israel, and so on.
And I'm looking on down this list. You've got Germany, Norway, Spain, Uruguay, Sweden, Switzerland, South Africa, Estonia, Finland, France, 25. How did you go about your report, Nathaniel?
Well, this is an aggregate of research that the Palm Center and other groups have been doing for many years. But those groups actually include the U.S. military. The military and the U.S. government, the Government Accountability Office, have done studies on this in the past. And each time they find that there's no rationale, there's no basis for the assertion that open gay service undercuts cohesion. And each time, up until now, the military has tried to sort of ignore the studies or bury the studies even when they had commissioned them. So we also talked to experts around the world and did a review of literature mm-hmm. on cohesion theory and literature by, you know, the British Ministry of Defense and many of the militaries that lifted their bans who did their own assessments. And the results were uniformly that this transition had been a success, particularly if the transition itself was implemented swiftly, which is something that's a matter of debate here in the U.S. right now.
We'll talk about that. Now, your group, the Palm Center, as I understand, has no official position on this, but
The New York Times describes you as a leading force among advocates for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You've written a book called Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. You've written in, the L.A. Times saying, let's repeal this and repeal it quickly. So you are in kind of an advocacy position, even as you've been doing this research. Is that fair to say?
Sure. It's about academic freedom. The Palm Center is a research group that has a small staff, but also commissions research by scholars around the world. So the center doesn't take a position in terms of lobbying, and we're very committed to allowing the scholars who do work at the Palm Center to express, you know, the results of their research and what they're persuaded of. And certainly that's what I've been doing over the past few years.
So help us learn what you found globally. First of all, here you've got 25 countries with gay military service as policy. How far back does this go? Are these countries that have always had it? Sort of, you know, some of these are very old nations. Have they had it since the dawn of time? Is this relatively new? What's it look like on that front?
There's actually a wide range of histories to these. The Netherlands was among the first, not terribly surprisingly, to lift their ban in the early 1970s. Then there are a range of countries that never actually had policies, in part because some of those countries culturally and by law don't recognize homosexuality. Our list doesn't include many of those countries, particularly in Asia and Africa, where it's still not discussed and not recognized in law and culture.
Do you mean it's so taboo that they can't talk about it, so they have no policy against it, or something else?
Right. That's actually often the case. Mm-hmm. This list of 25 mm-hmm. doesn't include mm-hmm. most of those nations, but historically mm-hmm. there are a few nations that that adopted a non-discrimination policy after having no policy. So in cases, particularly in Asia and Africa, where there's no policy of non-discrimination and there's often a practice of discrimination, we didn't include those countries on the list.
And what about some of those who adopted it more recently, the UK, others? What prompted them to do it, and how long have they had open gay service in their militaries?
Israel, Canada, and Australia lifted their bans in 1992 and 93. Britain, which is one of the most similar culturally and militarily to the U.S., did so in 2000. In almost all cases, these changes came from outside the military. It's rare that a military comes along and says, we've decided that we want to broaden our personnel base to reflect the country more. Although in each case, the military rather quickly sees that that's actually more effective, that they don't want to have too big of a civil-military gap. There's a whole literature about that. So in most cases, there were either court cases or a government panel, sometimes responding to cultural and political developments, sometimes responding to personnel needs. But in each case, in the ones that we studied in depth, the militaries recognized and acknowledged that the government or the court, whatever the case was in their case, was going to mandate this change, and they recognized that the research says we ought to do this swiftly and cleanly and not drag it out.
So, for example, in the case of the UK, I think it was an EU human rights ruling that compelled them to change their policy just, a couple of years ago? What's their experience been?
It was 1999, the European Court of Human Rights, and it was in September. And by January, about 3.5 months later, Britain had accepted the decision and overturned the policy in that quick of a time. Their experience was that again and again they looked at this policy, first in the months after implementing it, and then in the years after implementing it, and then we consulted MOD officials, Ministry of Defense officials, more recently. And they confirm that these results hold up over time. Britain's policy of non-discrimination is now 10 years old as of last month. And they find that there has been no impact, that it was hailed as a solid achievement. Those are quotes from the Ministry of Defense itself. And that in many cases and in many ways, and this is slightly harder to measure, but there's certainly evidence suggesting this, the command climate improved, that other minorities experienced a greater degree of respect, that people were able to focus more on behavior and on the mission rather than on questions and even rumors and gossip about the sexual orientation of some subgroup of the population. In some cases, harassment went down. It's hard to know if that was caused by this change, but it's certainly consistent with what the research would suggest, which is that in the U.S., part of the problem with Don't Ask, Don't Tell is that it It means that when people are suffering from harassment, if they're gay or lesbian or perceived to be so, they feel they can't go to authorities to complain about it because their own sexuality may come under investigation, whether they're gay or straight. And so it's not surprising that when a policy of openness prevails, that harassment is easier to deal with and the incidence of reporting harassment reports may decrease.
We'll look at the details of this, cohesion, unit cohesion and so on. But what about the cultural difference? I mean, even in the UK, as you say, perhaps the closest, or historically so to the United States. I mean, if you go back, Winston Churchill was first Lord of the Admiralty, and he once talked, no doubt kind of joking, but nevertheless you can't imagine an American general. He talked about the tradition in the British Navy, the traditions of rum, bum, and the lash, you know, booze, gay sex in that case, and harsh punishment. Does that bespeak a different culture? Can you compare cultures?
That actually reflects a similarity of culture, a similarity between Britain and the U.S. In terms of the hostility to homosexuality and concerns about it. Each culture and each nation and each military is unique, and people in the U.S. are fond of mentioning, and I think it's true, that the U.S. military is in a class by itself. It's the strongest and most powerful in the world. But there's a whole section in the Palm Center's new study about the relevance of foreign militaries. The Army actually set up a foreign military studies office in the 80s. Because it constantly turns to militaries, including smaller ones and less strong ones, to learn lessons. And I think there's a kind of idea that in Europe and Canada, all of this went over without a hitch and there was no opposition to homosexuality. That's actually not true, and we detail that in the study. Mm-hmm. There was enormous resistance, including by the service chiefs, particularly in Australia and in Britain. The same disruptions were predicted. None of them came true.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gays in militaries around the world and the impending U.S. decision on Don't Ask, Don't Tell here in this country. Testimony on Capitol Hill this week from top Army brass. Also a new report out from the Palm Center at the University of California, Santa Barbara, looking at the experience of 25 countries around the world that where gays serve openly. It's a big list. Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, and right on down through Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, the UK, and Uruguay. We've got the lead author of that report with us this hour, Nathaniel Frank. He joins us from Washington. We're also joined this hour by James Bowman. He's a resident scholar at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. His piece entitled Don't Change, Don't Ask, Don't Tell ran last October in the Weekly Standard. He's author of Honor, A History. James Bowman, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So Nathaniel Frank and his crew of researchers have looked around the world, and they come back with a very positive report that no overall diminution of military effectiveness in these countries, no problems with the transition to full inclusion, no delayed problems over the years, improved command climate, you know, and right on down. What do you think about this kind of report and its relevance to the American debate, James?
Well, a couple of things. The report is based on self-reported data. You ask a bureaucrat anywhere in the world, military or civilian, how's the new policy going, and he's going to answer you, great, great, great. That's just in the nature of bureaucracy. I think you would be very hard to find a bureaucrat who would answer differently than that.
But this is about their militaries. I mean, any country, I would think, if it was having real problems in its core defense, would have to have an open conversation about it, wouldn't you?
Why would you think that?
We're having one in this country, and if national defense depends on it.
Yes, I'm not sure we are having an open conversation. I think the realities of bureaucracy and government are such that that there's an enormous pressure on the military to accept what their civilian leaders are imposing upon them.
I mean, we had top generals yesterday saying they had deep reservations about
this. Well, yes, I mean that gives you some indication of how strong the feeling must be.
But that is open conversation. Just to that point, that is open conversation. just to be,
well, it is open conversation, but it's constrained openness, shall we say. There is always pressure on the establishment to fall into line behind policy, and that's what the establishment invariably does.
So maybe there's some restraint. Nevertheless, here's a lot of positive answers. Do you find the 25 countries' experience irrelevant?
Well, I don't think it's irrelevant, but it is a very limited relevance, particularly because all of these countries have peacetime militaries. If they are involved, as Britain is, and one or two other countries are in Afghanistan, for instance, Britain was for a while in mm-hmm. Iraq. It's a tiny proportion of their armed forces, and their global responsibilities don't come anywhere near being what ours are. We are the leading military in the world, the one on which world peace and security depends. I think the stakes are very much higher with us than they are with these other countries, who can afford to indulge in social experiments as we cannot, I think.
Nathaniel Frank, let's just jump in on these two points. First of all, James Bowman says it's self-reported data. These are bureaucrats talking about their own system. They're not going to criticize it. Secondly, he says, you know, limited relevance. The United States has much greater tasks, challenges, so it's just not the same. What do you say?
Well, first of all, it's not true that it relies only on self-reported data. We took British Ministry of Defense reports that were internal, that had been leaked, that were an effort to give, as you said, the higher-ups a totally candid assessment of how things were working. When you take the research, and this is not just the Palm Center's research, as mm-hmm. I suggested earlier on, there's dozens of studies across 50 years. The military began researching this in the 1950s and frequently bucked the trend and bucked policy. So the research is overwhelming and comes from so many different data points and so many countries at this point that I think you'd be hard-pressed to suggest that, you know, this is cherry-picking or relies on self-reported data. As far as the relevance, as I said, we have a section on the relevance of foreign militaries. The global responsibility of the U.S., I think, is undisputed. The question is, in order for the U.S. to remain strong, does that require anti-gay exclusion? And there's never been any evidence saying that that is. And there's nothing that's socially experimental about recognizing what all the service members, for the most part, the majority already say that they believe, that they're working with gay peers. So, you know, in the 40s, when we did racial integration, the mm-hmm. military was out front of society. At this point, the military is far behind society. And the whole idea that this was a social experiment, I think, is mostly a sort of, you know, echoing a talking point of opposition to racial integration. But there's that's not grounded in any reality today. This is about the policy catching up with the reality. It's far from a social experiment.
Let me ask you about a couple of particular concerns. I mean, no doubt some of the resistance to this is could be rooted in bigotry, but others have put forward sort of almost philosophical arguments about it or operational arguments about it. One concern has been, you know, you might have lots and lots of gays coming out, so much that the institution couldn't absorb the open fact of their presence. And another would that there'd be more harassment if gays were openly identified in the military, or that serving military would leave, heterosexual, straight military members would leave because of the open acknowledgement of gay comrades. What did you find globally on those fronts, Nathaniel?
Well, a couple things. The research shows consistently that these fears were also in place in these other countries and that none of them came true. In Canada and Britain, 2/3 of service members polled in major surveys before they lifted their bans said that they would refuse to work with gays. And when the bans were lifted anyway, almost none of them left. We're talking 2 to 3 people. Those polls predicted thousands of people. If you were sort of naive enough to conflate a poll with a prediction of behavior, polls don't predict behavior. They gauge values. The idea that the military couldn't absorb the openness is such a vague concern. I mean, open service, it really ought to be called simply honest service. I think there's this stereotype that, you know, gays are wanting to express themselves and that they want to prance around in pink boas and they're not going to conform and wear the military uniform. I mean, all we're talking about is allowing gay people to be honest about their lives in exactly the same way that straight people are. So I think it's important to recognize that part of what's going on is a strategy by opponents to make this seem much scarier and more complicated than it is. And what the research shows is that despite these same fears elsewhere, none of them came true in any way that added to the overall impairment of military effectiveness.
James Bowman, you've written about honor at great length, and you've drawn a thread kind of between honor, a certain kind of comradeship, and heterosexuality. But do you see or do you have evidence looking around the world that this open service has been a problem in other countries, James?
Well, it's the it's the kind of a problem that would not show up in research, I think. You know those few who say this is why I'm leaving. You don't know those who don't reenlist because they find the work environment uncongenial. In the same way, what they call unit cohesion is something that is not really susceptible of measurement. You ask for evidence. It's pretty hard to imagine how it would be possible to measure a thing like that. It has to do with the feelings between men in extreme conditions. All we have to go on is what the men themselves tell us, and it seems to me that that deserves a certain amount of consideration from people like Mr. Frank, who seem to think that they don't deserve any consideration at all. That it should be imposed upon them.
I have said to the contrary that it's absolutely important to consult the troops to assess what their sentiments are, to take seriously their concerns and their anxieties. That's not the same as asking permission from an 18-year-old enlisted person about how to set military policy. So I would add, and it's not just men, that there are women in the military, which often seem to be left out of the theories that Mr. Bowman discusses about the importance of masculine honor and heterosexual honor being at the basis of unit cohesion. I think it's true that cohesion is notoriously difficult to measure, but the military does its best when it puts its mind to it, and that's why, you know, self-reporting is a part of that, but which involves assessing whether people in the unit from the commanders on down experienced in their perception any impairment of cohesion or any impairment of effectiveness. And so if nothing is showing up and the impact isn't being affected, that itself is evidence when you pile up enough of it.
Nathaniel Frank, James Bowman, please stand by. We have a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let me begin to invite them in. In Montgomery, Alabama, we've got Kip calling. Kip, you are on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make a couple comments. Righteousness is a nation's greatest asset. And if we go into other countries and we are clearly showing homosexuality is what we're fighting for, we have a definite problem. In addition, the Presidio in San Francisco was closed down, not just because of some type of BRAC. It was because of the indiscretions of the doctors there. There's a lot of homosexual doctors that were monsters and ended up closing down the base for the Army post. So,
Kip, we take your points. Let me ask you, if I may, we're hearing findings that it's working all right in other countries, 25 other countries around the world. What does that say to you? Anything? Is that significant to you or not?
Yes, the previous caller was right on the target there. Policy in the military, whatever the policy, it's all about yes, sir, no, sir, will do, follow through. And they're not going to tell you when times are hard. I have a lot of personal experience. I started out enlisted in the Army, became a warrant officer, flew helicopters, flew for the Air Force as a commissioned officer, was a captain, and I recruited, or rather, I was an officer training school instructor and created some lieutenants in the Air Force. I've been at the close quarters. Through all that experience, I've seen where executive officers end up with crew chiefs getting married after their service, and it made you wonder what was going on while they were in service and how they formed the relationship. There's enough distractions already, and if you add to that with the homosexuality, it's too big a price to pay for some young kid that comes in and gets abused, and they will be abused, and there's already enough of it going on with women being raped in the military. And if it goes the other way with men on men, it's going to be a horrific scene. And if it was a Marine in a port in Japan or a port in the Philippines or wherever we still have a foothold, they will get chased out of the country.
Kip, we've got your perspective, and I appreciate it. Nathaniel Frank, what about it? First of all, the question raised here about what our military, for better or worse, goes into a lot of countries around the world. What if it's going, as Kip raises, to countries whose culture is very resistant to homosexuality? Is there a risk? Did you find in these other countries you studied that the military itself could be seen as a transmission line for sexuality, more open sexuality than a country where that military is supposed to be working can handle?
Well, when a military goes into a country to fight, often it's antagonizing the other country because they're at war. That's going to be a far greater source of resentment and anger, after all, this is war, than...
But we're in these countries for years, very often. It turns into, occupation in Iraq, long-term presence. Maybe it's not a problem, but I wonder.
Well, it's certainly not a problem. I mean, the research makes that clear that many other countries, including Britain, I mean, the coalition that was involved in both the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were full of many different cultures and many multicultural countries. You know, there are Jews, there are African Americans, there are so many different kinds of people. Only when it comes to gay people is it considered appropriate to give a litmus test and act on the assumption, and again, this is an assumption not borne out in any kind of research, that somehow... and also that when you extend equal treatment to homosexuals, that would somehow mean that the military is going into the other country, as the caller said, in order to fight for homosexuality. That's nothing to do with what we're talking about here. So I'd also say it's very important to face the reality. There have always been gay people in the military. The majority of service members already know that they're serving with gays. In other words, they're already open. So there's no research showing that allowing gays to serve or serve openly increases harassment. That's based on an old stereotype that gay people are sexual predators.
And what about
as the caller said, heterosexuals are much more of the problem, both in terms of numbers and I think in terms of what the research shows in terms of incidence of sexual harassment against women.
And what did you find globally on the concern Kip raised about relationships, gay relationships, influencing maybe unduly service effectiveness or how command was carried out?
Well, again, there are women in the military, and there always have been. I mean, not always have been, but there have been for a very long time. Our military is dependent on the 15 to 20%, depending on the service, of women that we have. That's a far greater problem, but the military has in place policies, regulations, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, most of which is already gender neutral and will apply to everyone across the board. And this should be about behavior, not about singling out one group of people based on stereotypes about how they're going to behave.
Let's get a call from Michelle in Columbia, South Carolina. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment. I was in the military for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I went in the Women's Army Corps in 1976, and I retired in 1996. I took basic training twice, one for enlisted, and there were plenty of lesbians in my recruitment class, and the cadre was all lesbian. When I took officer basic training, I would say that half of the female class was lesbian, and all of the cadre, again, was lesbian.
When you say cadre, you mean officers?
Yeah, the officers. Mm-hmm. Well, some of the cadre in basic training were enlisted.
Okay.
But all the way through the Army, we were aware of who was gay and who was lesbian. They all did their jobs. Some of them you couldn't tell because people think if a man sways or a woman wears man's pants, they're either gay or lesbian. But that's not always so. But there was one particular soldier, he's retired now, and he swayed his hips and threw his arms, and everybody knew he was gay, but he did a good job. And they don't have to have the people from the top.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gays in militaries around the world and the impending now U.S. decision on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The Pentagon in the middle of a year-long study at the request of President Barack Obama, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, the first chairman to say, okay, Maybe we should do this. We heard some resistance from top Army and Air Force generals, chiefs of staff, just yesterday on Capitol Hill. The questions before the country. Nathaniel Frank is with us. His Palm Center at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has just put out a big study on how 25 countries around the world that permit open homosexuality in their armed services have experienced that policy. James Bowman is with us. He's a resident scholar at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's written in opposition to gay service, in open gay service in the U.S. military. We'll be joined in just a moment by Max Boot, but let's get another call here. Dubuque, Iowa. Becca, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you see, Becca?
Well, hey, I had two really quick questions. First, I was talking to a friend of mine who attends military academy, and he's opposed to repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept referring, when I asked him why, he kept referring to his traditional values. And when I hear that, I kind of, you know, hear religious, and I'm wondering why this isn't confined to a religious debate. And my second comment is, you had asked at the top of the show about whether or not, you know, we were influenced by the fact that all these other countries had no Don't Ask, Don't Tell policies. And I'm from Iowa, you know, we allow gay marriage, and I'm just wanted to say when we made that decision, we didn't consider what the other states did. We wanted to do what was right, and I think that's the case here. I don't think it matters what the other countries are doing. I think it's the right thing to do, and we should decide it based on that alone.
Becca, appreciate your call, and thanks for it. James Bowman, Becca pushing back there against the notion of traditional values, which she interprets as religious opposition. We heard our caller earlier, Kip, say it's about righteousness. How do you see those factors coming in here, James, or should they?
Well, it's not it's not just about religion. There are religious objections to homosexual behavior, but I think that's not what the military is concerned with. It's rather the tradition of honor, which has to do with manliness and masculinity, which, like it or not, also has to do with heterosexuality, and if we're talking about tradition here.
Are you saying that gays can't be courageous, brave, honorable?
No, no, I'm not saying that, although I've been accused of saying that. It's rather that the unit cohesion that I talked of earlier, which is another name for honor, becomes compromised, I think, when the feelings that men in extreme situations, particularly in combat, have for each other can conceivably get mixed up with sexual feelings. I think that's the danger, and that's what the policy is in place to avoid. And I agree with Mr. Frank that there are and always have been gays serving in the military, and as Michelle from South Carolina said, everybody knew mm-hmm. that they were doing their job. Well, that's the situation we have now, that we don't prohibit them from serving. We simply enforce a kind of discretion upon them, which is useful and indeed, I think, necessary for proper military behavior.
Nathaniel Frank, what did you find in your global study? Were there reports of, you know, subtle psychological dynamics that worked against the kind of, courage, honor, cohesion that we ask of our military? What about how they handled simple proximity? Were there separate facilities, or is everybody just dumped in together? What did you find, Nathaniel?
Well, there have not been separate facilities, and it's not a question of dumping everyone together. I mean, there are separate facilities for men and women, but not for gay and straight people. And
in none of these 25 countries?
That's right. And it's always been that way. There's never been, since maybe the Sacred Band of Thebes, a gay fighting force that's separated mm-hmm. out. It's been considered. But I think the question about religion is very important. I mean, in Unfriendly Fire, in my book, I go through the history of this policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The religious right was instrumental in ensuring that President Clinton failed to lift the ban. And their reasons, and this shows up in the congressional record consistently, were absolutely religious. Mr. Bowman's think tank, where he resides, the mission is to make Judeo-Christian values more relevant to public policy. And that's a big part of the history here, and continue, and even in other countries too, some of the opposition over which the bans were lifted were also religious. I don't think it's right to say that unit cohesion is another name for honor. Cohesion depends on many variables. But these days, those variables can certainly include gay straight bonding. There's simply no basis to assert that unit cohesion relies on heterosexism.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may, from New York. We are joined by Max Boot. He's a fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of War Made New. He has reported from many corners of the world and many military fronts. Max Boot, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
You're seen as kind of a conservative, thinker. How do you see the question of open service by gays in the military in other countries, in this country? A problem? Not a problem? Should we ditch Don't Ask, Don't Tell or not?
I guess my position is somewhere between Nathaniel Frank and James Bowman. I mean, I'm basically sympathetic to the idea of gay rights. And I think a lot of the military restrictions don't make any sense at all, because most folks who are in the military essentially work in an office setting, whether it's in the Pentagon, at Fort Bragg, or at a giant forward operating base in Iraq or Afghanistan. They basically, in those places, which I visited extensively, most personnel live in trailers. They have shower facilities. They usually have flush toilets. It's not just bunk style. It's not living out in a foxhole without a change of clothing or without a shower. It's very similar to a normal office environment. And in those kinds of settings, there's actually a lot of privacy. There are women who are present on those bases as well as men. Link-ups occur between men and women, and those are managed within they occasionally cause problems, but are managed within the military system. And so to me, it's crazy that we're, discharging some gay personnel who are linguists or who have other vital skills, most of whose service is going to be in these kinds of settings. I can't see any reason at all for that.
Mm.
I think there are more genuine issues which are raised in a few settings, which comprise really a minority of all the military occupational specialties, but really having to do with frontline combat units where there is very little privacy. Unit cohesion is at a very high premium. And I discussed this issue about a year and a half ago. I happened to be out in the field with a special forces unit, and we just got to kind of BSing one night and talking about various things. And I was really struck by the unanimity and depth of their opposition to lifting the gays in the military ban.
Open gays.
To me, I was surprised by that. Open gays, right? I mean, I was surprised by that because I thought sentiment had shifted in the public at large and within the military.
Mm-hmm.
As you see from the fact that General Colin Powell and others who opposed lifting the ban in the early 1990s are now in favor of it.
But how would you draw that line, Max, if I may ask? I mean, if someone is openly gay away from the front, they may be assigned to the front. They're already open. I mean, how do you have don't ask, don't tell in some spots and not others? People move around.
Well, I think it would be possible because basically you would certainly have in the future, as you have today, gay personnel serving in combat units or in submarines and other close-quarters settings. But it could be theoretically possible that they wouldn't be able to divulge their sexuality if they want to continue in that kind of service, just as women are currently barred from those occupations. But, I mean, I view that as being kind of a halfway step for the moment, if it's necessary, if the inclusion of openly gay personnel would, in fact, harm unit cohesion, as some of these special forces troopers I talked with suggested. And I think over time, you've seen more and more jobs open up to women, and I think you could see the same thing happen with gays. But already right now, I think, 90% of the military occupational specialties could easily be thrown open to openly gay personnel without any impact at all.
Interestingly, I see just yesterday the Pentagon said that it's moving ahead with plans to end the U.S. military's ban on women serving in submarines.
Right, and that's an interesting sign of how more jobs are being opened to women. And those issues are raised there, and in some ways those issues are more troubling than the issues raised by gays, because with women and men, you have the possibility of pregnancy, which is a real loss for units if women are taken out of their jobs because they get pregnant. And that's not something that happens in gay relationships. So in some ways, the presence of gays could be, less disruptive than the presence of women. But I think overall the presence of women has worked out fine. It really has not confirmed a lot of the worst case predictions that were made by opponents of the policy in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Nathaniel Frank, what's your world survey say to you on this front? What about the idea of drawing some lines? Gays could serve openly here, but not there. What do you say?
Well, the problem is that continues to be an unnecessary and costly policy. What the research shows from these other countries is that there is surprising evidence of not only openly gay service in office jobs, but in combat. Mr. Bowman earlier mentioned that the other countries that we've studied are peacetime militaries. That's not the case anymore. In Operation Mountain Thrust in Afghanistan, Britain, Canada, even the Netherlands took the lead in routing Taliban forces. So we have evidence in this report of gays in combat units. That's where, as Max Boot said, unit cohesion and effectiveness is most critical. And we need Arabic translators on the ground in hostile terrain in Iraq and Afghanistan. So when all the research shows that there is no reason for this ban, and even the military's own research now is saying that the policy undermines unit cohesion by yanking people out of cohesive forces and compromise integrity, then why would you want to maintain a sort of another halfway step? That's what Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been.
Let's go to Troy in Iowa City. Troy, you're on the air.
Yes, I got two quick questions. Mm-hmm. Well, number one, where should a gay male shower, with the women or with the men? And the next question is what happens if the enlistment drops by 90% of it, 90% because more gays are coming into the military, and if you're only gay, you go into the military?
Troy, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Nathaniel, let's take the second one first. What about enlistment?
As I've mentioned, in other countries, surveys suggested that people would leave, and it never happened. These are doomsday scenarios, including, I think, the first question, the idea that, gay men should shower with women. I'm not sure quite how seriously to take the question, but I will try to take it seriously. I mean, gay men are not women. Gay men and straight men and gay boys and straight boys have been showering together in gyms and have been, in school for time immemorial. That's what the cultural norm is, and that's what the norm should be in the military, as it already is. This is simply a question of acknowledging that reality that some people would prefer to sort of stick their head in the sand about.
But what about recruitment? I mean, one interesting difference here is you're looking at 25 countries. Some have voluntary military service. The United States certainly does. Others are mandatory. If you have mandatory service, it presumably is harder to ask gays not to be open because everybody's required to be in there, like Israel,
right.
Let's say.
Right. With the exception of Israel, the majority of the countries that have openly gay service do not have mandatory service. In these other countries, Canada and Britain, 2/3 said they would refuse to serve. In the U.S., the surveys say that 10%, not 2/3, would refuse to serve, and another 14% would consider it. There's a whole literature about polling and about the caution of confusing a poll with a predictor of behavior when, in fact, a poll is a poll. It assesses opinion. It's an opportunity to express values. And there's evidence again and again of people citing these polls as a kind of doomsday scenario. And, the idea that our professional service members in the U.S. would throw away a military career simply because they have to acknowledge, not even start serving with gays because they already are, but acknowledge the reality that they've always been serving with gays, I don't think is borne out by reality.
Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am shocked. I'm on one hand, I'm really pleased that this dialogue is opening up more. I have a personal experience. My son is gay. Mm-hmm. And his partner, and they've been together for 3 years, is a veteran of the Air Force, has working for Boeing, and has a top security clearance with doing satellite communications. He is no longer active duty because of the don't ask, don't tell kind of fear. Mm-hmm. To me, there's still this vein that's very strong of homophobia. And just like I'm sure in World War I, World War II, even the idea of African Americans serving, I'm sure the same sense, different words, but the same sentiment of fear and ignorance existed then as it does now. It's time as our society is opening more to the idea of inclusion of people that are different. We're all human beings, and these gays, this idea of gays in the military being predators, what about in government? Is there a litmus test when you're elected to become an elected official?
Obviously not.
I'm shocked that still there's this homophobia and fear and ignorance that gays are human beings just like I am.
Jim, we've got your perspective. Our time is very short here. Forgive me, but I want to go to James Bowman. James, what do you say to this, Father?
Well, I don't think it's true to say that I am either fearful or ignorant. It's a question that needs to be discussed in reasonable terms, in terms of what is best for our military effectiveness, and I think that the example of racial integration is not a relevant one. That race and ethnicity are not behavioral qualities. People do not behave in a certain way, but simply because they're black or another religion.
Although that's not how that was perceived in the 1940s. Certainly. Yeah,
and Max, let me ask you: what about the recruitment front? We've just got a minute here, Max. But do you perceive potential problems if there's open gay service? Is it going to be a recruitment problem, or what do you think, Max?
Well, again, I think this is mainly an issue with the minority of frontline combat troops, and the caller raises the issue of homophobia, and I think that is a reality that we have to take into account. It does exist, and there could be some damage to unit cohesion and possibly recruiting for some of these frontline units. I mean, I'm not approving of the attitudes, but I think we have to acknowledge that they exist, and we have to be very careful about tampering with the world's finest military, which is why, you know, I'm suggesting that maybe we would extend open gay service to the vast majority of the force, perhaps not quite yet to the frontline combat elements, but, you know, I think it's open to debate.
Nathaniel Frank, you say change the policy, change it now, do it fast. Do you think the Pentagon is listening, watching what's going on with other militaries around the world?
I do think so. They always have, and the question will be whether they heed what the research says, which is to do it swiftly and cleanly. I think the Pentagon does plan to relax enforcement of the policy, and the question will then be thrown to Congress.
Nathaniel Frank with the Palm Center, University of California, James Bowman, and Max Boot, great to have all of you with us. Thank you so much. Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.